Ooh, you want to play psycho killer? Can I be the helpless victim?
Cross your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life!
Welcome. I'm your scream queen, Jenica Olin. This is my fifth episode. We're all new here, so I will tell you a little bit about what you're listening in on. My objective for this podcast is to delve into the themes of horror, both real and imagined. Each episode will cover one movie in depth based on a theme of the month. For December, I'm putting horror in the holidays with Black Christmas. In today's episode, I will be slaying it this Christmas with the Black Christmas 2006 remake written and directed by Glenn Morgan. The movie has a cast that any girl growing up in the 90s era will die for. Our final girl, Katie Cassidy, made her name as a scream queen with leading roles in When a Stranger Calls and starring as Chris Fowles in the 2010 remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street. Michelle Thatchenberg plays Melissa. She is a beloved idol of mine as I grew up watching her play Buffy's little sister Dawn Summers in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Then we have Mary Winstead as Heather Fitzgerald, who gained her reputation as a scream queen in films like Final Destination 3, Death Proof, and the horror series Wolf Lake. Lacey Chabert, I think I said that right, plays Dana. So Lacey is another one of those actresses that hits hard. She is more commonly known as Gretchen Wieners in Mean Girls. Then we have Crystal Lau, who is the drunk and belligerent Lauren Hannon. She's another scream queen with roles in Children of the Corn, Revelation 2001, Final Destination 3, made in 2006, and Wrong Turn 2, Dead End 2007. We have a returning actress from the original Black Christmas, Andrea Martin. She played Phyllis in the original 1974 Black Christmas. In an interview, she said that she hadn't thought about Black Christmas for 32 years and it came out of the blue. A quick layout of this podcast. Each episode will have an intro, brief synopsis of the movie, an analysis of the film, and then we get into the true crime of it all. I'm a huge true crime fan, and I like to make connections between the true horrors that inspire our darkest imaginations. The truth is, the stuff on screen is way tamer than the true horrors that take place every day. Let's set the scene with a synopsis of the movie.
15 years ago, on Christmas Eve, his family became his victims.
What have you done?
Not gonna let up.
A group of college friends.
That sucks. Everyone should be home for Christmas.
Are about to discover.
Lauren, we're opening up presents.
Why don't you open the present we got you?
Their house.
I got it.
Is his home.
All is calm. All is bright. Who is in my house tonight?
Don't you have lots of toys to deliver to good little boys and girls?
You really shouldn't provoke somebody like that.
And on December 25th...
You're definitely getting punked.
Is that Santa's reindeer?
All he wants for Christmas...
Is Megan in her room?
...is a new family he can treat like his very own.
On a snowy winter night on Christmas Eve, in the Alpha Kappa Gamma sorority house, Lauren is getting changed into her pajamas. In the next room, Claire Crosby is writing a Christmas card to her half-sister, Lee. Suddenly, she hears something from her closet. She goes over to the closet door and looks inside. Nothing but clothes. She goes back to her card and sees that her fountain pen is missing. Suddenly, a figure wraps a bag around her head In the struggle, the figure stabs the pen in her eye. At the mental institute, not far away, Billy Lenz is being served his Christmas dinner. He is locked away, rocking back and forth in his rocking chair, safely in his cell that is decorated with Christmas lights. Billy opens the small window on his cell and places a present wrapped in newspaper on the ledge for the security guard. The security guard opens it to find nothing that interesting, except on the newspaper is written, "I'll be home for Christmas." The security guard looks into the cell to find it empty, and Billy's chair rocking back and forth. As Billy comes from under the bed and stabs him in the neck with a candy cane, Billy leaves the cell and kills the man dressed as Santa. Outside of the sorority house, Kelly Presley and her boyfriend, Kyle Autry, are talking in the car. She tells him that she is going to spend Christmas with her roommates, but that she will make it up to him. As she kisses him goodbye and goes inside the house, in the sorority house, they have a secret Santa gift-giving thing going. And Miss Mac wants to know who got Billy. According to her, Billy killed his family here. When Billy was born, he had a liver disorder that made his skin yellow. His father loves him regardless, but his mother is disappointed and wants nothing to do with him. They live in the house that is now the sorority house. As Billy gets a bit older, he's treated even worse by his mother, who has become an alcoholic. On Christmas, when he is 5, his mother tells him that Santa was shot down by the Russians. His father, however, tells him he has a present for him hidden in a stowaway space in Billy's closet. Billy goes into his room, which will become Eve's room in present day, and finds a telescope, making him briefly very happy. However, his mother and father are not getting along very well, and his mom is having an affair. Moments after finding the telescope, Billy hears arguing and looks under the door to witness his father with a bag over his head and his head being bashed in with a hammer. Billy runs back to his room as his mother and her lover take the body outside and begin to bury it in the crawl space under the house. Billy is watching this and is discovered. His mother chases him into the attic and locks him in there. All of the girls are horrified by the story, but Miss Mac assures them it's all true. Heather says she was the one who drew Billy's name for the Secret Santa, but she thought it was wrong to buy him a gift because he was a murderer and it was offensive to the birth of Jesus to make a mockery of gift giving. Heather starts to go upstairs to her room but runs into Eve. Eve has been upstairs the whole time and is leaving to go visit her family. She gives Heather her Secret Santa gift, a crystal statue of a unicorn. Kelly and Lauren go upstairs to tell Claire and Megan they're going to open presents. Claire obviously doesn't answer. Lauren pounds on the door and says she's going to steal her presents if she doesn't get down here. Laughing, Kelly does this to Megan's door. Megan tells them to go away and she doesn't want to open presents. They leave and Megan hears a snow globe tune playing in the attic. She goes to the attic and gets more than she bargains for when she finds Claire's body by the window in a rocking chair. She's attacked by someone, and she tries to fight back, but the figure rips out one of her eyes with their bare hands. The home phone rings. Melissa answers it and puts it on loudspeaker. The caller's making all sorts of weird noises. Lauren teases him, and the caller threatens to kill Lauren before hanging up. Heather says someone is obviously sick in the head and doesn't need to be provoked by Lauren. Melissa checks the caller ID and is surprised to see it's coming from Megan's cell. They assure themselves it's just a joke. They open their presents, with Miss Mac getting some lingerie as a gag gift. Everyone laughs and Kelly goes back upstairs to check on the girls. Kyle suddenly pops out of Megan's room. Kelly screams and the other girls rush upstairs. Kyle apologizes and says he wanted to surprise her. Miss Mack asks if Megan is in her room, and Kyle says he doesn't know. Lauren asks him how could he have just been in her room and not know if she is there. He explains that it's really dark in there. He makes a joke about Billy getting her. He then tells everyone another story about Billy's past. Billy was kept in the attic for many years. His mother and stepfather lived happily without him. On Christmas, when Billy was 12, she crept into the attic and raped him, her own son. 9 months later, she gave birth to a baby girl named Agnes. She loves Agnes and uses the occasion to further reject Billy, looking up to the attic where Billy is kept and saying in reference to Agnes, "She's my family now." As Agnes grew older, Billy became jealous. One Christmas, Agnes got a doll for a present. A jealous Billy goes on a killing spree and breaks the attic door open. He attacks Agnes and pulls out one of her eyes, stabbing his stepfather in the face and beating his mom to death with a dough roller. When the police arrive on the scene, they find him eating cookies made from his mother's flesh. Agnes was put into an orphanage and no one knows where she is today. The girls are freaking out by the story. As Kyle leaves, a figure is standing by the tree looking at the presents. Miss Mack asks who the person is. Claire's half-sister, Lee, tells the girls that Claire never called her, telling her she was ready to be picked up and she's worried. Suddenly, the power goes out in the house. Dana says the circuit breaker is under the house and she will go turn it on. She goes outside and smokes, dropping her cigarette into a hole in the porch. She hears someone underneath. Taking her flashlight, she opens the door to the crawl space and looks inside.
Crazy bitch, I can see your breath.
Suddenly, someone grabs her, pulling her in. The two struggle as the figure grabs a gardening tool and stabs Dana in the head. In the house, Lauren is beyond drunk now, having been drinking booze the whole night. Melissa tells her she smells and needs to shower, starts asking where the other girls are since Claire, Megan, and Dana have disappeared. Kelly questions what is taking Dana so long and is even more startled when someone calls from Dana's cell number and hangs up. The rest of the girls go outside to look for Dana. Heather and Lee find Eve's car still parked outside. They open the door and scream as Eve's severed head rolls out. The girls scream and run back into the house, locking the door behind them. Kelly calls the police, but because of the snow, it may take over 2 hours for them to arrive. Miss Mack tells everyone they can pile into her car and try to find help. Kelly wants to stay together and doesn't think it will be safe on the roads. Heather and Miss Mack decide to leave and try to find help. When Miss Mack gets out of the car to scrape the ice off the windshield, the car starts to shake and Billy's yellow eye comes into view inside the car. Miss Mack gasps as he kills Heather, her blood spraying all over the windshield.
What is that thing?
Are you kidding?
Bitch, frigid southern princess.
Miss Mack falls against the garage door, causing an icicle to fall from above, which impales her head. Lee notices that Miss Mack hasn't left yet. She decides to go see what's going on. Kelly decides to go with her, leaving Melissa and a sleeping Lauren upstairs. As they leave the house, a figure grabs Heather's unicorn statue and walks down the hall. In the garage, Lee slips on Miss Mack's blood and screams. Upon hearing this, Melissa rushes toward the stairs. A figure grabs and wraps a bag over her head, slamming her into the wall. She rips the bag off and rushes through the house and into her room. She grabs a stick and hits the figure with it. Melissa opens a window and is going to climb out, but the figure throws an ice skate at her, cutting off the back of her head. Kelly and Lee rush inside and call for Melissa, but there's no answer, and they go to Lauren's room, closing the door behind them. But someone is on the other side of the door and kicks it open. It's Kyle. Lee attacks him, and he throws her against Lauren's bed, causing the covers to fall off of Lauren, who is very much dead with her eyes gouged out. Everyone screams, and Kyle insists he isn't the killer. Kelly calls Lauren's cell phone and hears it ringing in the attic. She explains that the killer might be in the attic with her phone. Kyle opens the attic door and is pulled inside. Kelly and Lee are trying to get into the attic, but the door slams shut. Kyle fights back as a bag is put over his head. Kelly breaks the door open and witnesses Kyle being stabbed with a unicorn statue. Then, one of his eyes being ripped out and eaten. Lee attacks the figure and is thrown across the attic, discovering her half-sister's body still in the rocking chair. The figure attacks Kelly, and Lee tries to help but is knocked into a hole in the floor. A bag is put over Kelly's head, but she grabs a fork and stabs the figure in the eye. She gets up and sees the figure has a glass eye. It's Agnes. Agnes attacks Kelly but is knocked into another hole in the floor that pins her between the walls. Billy pushes Kelly into the same hole, accidentally knocking over the candle. Kelly has grabbed onto a string of Christmas lights attached to a small tree, trying to keep from falling completely in. She screams for help as Agnes starts to crawl up the hole. Lee comes to her rescue, smashing open the wall. Agnes grabs Lee's head, but she manages to fight her off. Lee runs through the house and smashes out another wall, finally reaching the spot where Kelly is trapped. Billy is climbing into the hole and Agnes is crawling up it. Lee grabs Kelly and pulls her to safety as the Christmas tree catches fire, along with the rest of the attic, and falls into the hole, burning Agnes and Billy. The two survivors rush outside. Our next scene is at the hospital when Kelly is getting some tests done to make sure she's okay. They need her for some x-rays. Sometime later, Lee goes back to Kelly's room to see if she's back from the x-rays. A body with blonde hair lays in the bed, but as she approaches, the person turns over to reveal Agnes. Lee screams as Agnes grabs her by the throat and snaps her neck. Kelly comes back into the room and feels something is wrong. She finds Lee's new watch. She sees blood on the ceiling above her and starts to leave the room, but Agnes grabs her from behind the curtain and starts to strangle her. Kelly grabs a defibrillator paddle and shocks Agnes in the head with it, killing her. If you're in the UK, this is where the movie ended for you. But if you're in the US, we continue with the death of Billy. Billy comes down from the hospital's ceiling as Kelly rushes from the room. She grabs some crutches that are in the hall and starts to beat him with it. She turns to run, thinking he is unconscious, but he grabs her foot, causing her to fall over a medical cart. Billy grabs a scalpel from the pile of medical supplies now on the floor and takes chase. Kelly rushes to the stairs as Billy comes from behind, slashing her with the scalpel. She grabs him and throws him over the stairway, causing him to be impaled on top of the Christmas tree below. His intestines spew out and he is very much dead, and Kelly is left to look on in shock as the credits start.
Now is the part where I analyze the film. So the 2006 version is a pretty standard slasher that's reflective of the style and approach to horror in the mid-2000s. Staying in line with the original, the 2006 Black Christmas once again focuses on a group of sorority girls who this time have stayed behind on Christmas Eve as a snowstorm rages outside. The introduction of Agnes as a second killer was, according to Mary Elizabeth Winstead, incorporated in part to extend the film's narrative arc, given that the phone calls from within inside the house plot was too familiar at this point for audiences. The relationship between Billy and Agnes also allowed Morgan room to explore themes of family. By showing Billy's abusive and sadistic mother, we are able to see the humble beginnings of what can make a serial killer. The backstory given to Billy plays on a lot of what we know about serial killers. He's locked up in the attic for most of his life with no opportunity for social interaction. His yellow skin is symbolic of something being inherently wrong with him, and giving his mom a reason to show disgust towards the new baby boy. His mother is outwardly hateful towards him and takes pleasure in his emotional suffering. This is most prevalent when he is 5. His mother tells him Santa was shot down by the Russians. Moments where she is tormenting him are the only moments when we see her smiling. Then we have the brutal murder of the only person that ever cared for him, his father. He's killed with a trash bag over his head and is repeatedly smashed in the skull with a hammer. In this scene, you can see where he gets this fixation with asphyxiation by trash bags. Then we have the only horrific moment of affection she shows for her son, and 9 months later, there's baby Agnes. I'm so glad that scene is not lingered on. I don't really see what it adds to the plot aside from the intense disgust. I would have still seen their dynamic as dysfunctional, and everything else could have stayed the same without the incest being inserted into the mix. There are plenty of sibling rivalries that would mimic Billy's targeting of Agnes, without the whole incestuous thing. As a whole, this is one aspect that we missed from the original Black Christmas. Not the incest, but the backstory. We now know who Billy and Agnes are and why he prefers the attic. The sorority sisters are the opposing side of this family dynamic. While Billy grew up being treated like an outcast, these young ladies are accepting of each other, and they're even seen as like spoiled bitches. This time, we have our final girl telling her boyfriend she needs to spend time with her sorority sisters and be there for them during the holidays. This sprinkled in feminism is from the original movie when another character turned down her boyfriend to be with her sorority sisters as well. In another parallel to the original, Lauren is very much the same type of character as Barb. She's taken care of by her sisters. The character Melissa, played by Michelle Trachtenberg, is taking care of Lauren. She's holding her hair. She throws up. She's making sure she gets into the shower and then safely gets from the shower to the bed and has a puke bucket just in case of emergencies. That's what girls are for, right? This is the type of caring environment you would want to find yourself in. Something Billy and Agnes have no experience with. There's also an odd dynamic between the Claire, who is the first kill in the film, and her half-sister that just randomly shows up. Her sister comes because she's going to spend time with her and they want to get to know each other. There's a lot of emphasis on the fact that it's a half-sister, which personally strikes me as odd because I have half-siblings and I just call them my siblings. We're just, that's my brother, that's my sister. We're not I don't call them half. There's just like a degree of separation when you do that. So we don't have much insight into their relationship other than that they don't really have one. And we get the sense like they didn't grow up in the same household. This is another example of a broken household. But this one is a lot more familiar to those who were raised in separate households with two sets of parents. Funny enough, this is what should have happened with Billy's parents. Divorce is always an option, you guys. There's no need to murder your spouse as a way of separating. There are also themes of sanity and mental health like in here. Billy was not placed in a prison, but rather he was put in a mental hospital. The ethics around such a place come into question when watching this scene. The door is like a really solid deadbolted door. There's obviously no free roaming the hospital. They've got this small little window for exchanging trays of food. So it really is just isolation at its most extreme. If I'm correct, Billy is meant to be around 15 or 16 when he murdered his family and plucked his sister slash daughter's eye out. This all indicates that he was found to be insane and that he was imprisoned for all of his life. In the attic or in the cell, either one, he was imprisoned. He has not had a life outside of like a set of walls. I have a little note in here that he has never had a day without isolation, which is sad, but Billy's not a sympathetic character at all. I don't know if everyone caught it at the beginning of the movie. As the orderly is handing out food, the first hatch he opens has a man who looks like Jesus, and he says it's his birthday. I found it hilarious that they had Jesus locked up in the insane asylum celebrating his birthday. In these moments, you just really gotta think, what would Jesus do? So we know that the use of POV in the first Black Christmas was a major player in the atmosphere of the movie. We get a glimpse sometimes of like who's the one creeping through the halls, but they still keep us guessing as to who the killer is, because you see, you can tell that the POV is coming from more than one perspective. And if you pay attention to the timeline, you realize it's Agnes who's behind the initial slaughter of the sorority sisters. Let's now explore some of these tropes that started with the original Black Christmas and ended up in the remake, along with some newer tropes and the whole gore porn era of horror that seems to be making its way into little like with little snippets into this movie, with the eyeballs being eaten and all. All right, so we've got our bad Santa. He's in the asylum trying to have sex with a nurse. In the original, we've got the bad Santa, and he is Barb's boyfriend, and he's like getting kids drunk and cursing. So we've got the other trope, curiosity killed the cast. Megan is lured into the attic by footsteps and a snow tune and the snow globe tune, while Dana is lured into the crawl space by rustling noises. You guys, don't go into weird tight spaces like attics or crawl spaces searching for things. Like, even if it's not a murderous asshole, like, it's probably some animal down there that will attack you and maybe has rabies. And then we've got death by irony. So there's the whole, like, his mom, Miss Lenz, is like, you're my cookie. I could gobble you up. And then later she meets her demise when Billy uses the the roller to kill her, and then he's making cookies of her flesh and eating flesh cookies as the police come and get him. So that's very ironic. And it was also like a bit of foreshadowing that she's talking about cookies all the time, and you can see her nicely arranging the cookies for Santa and things like that. So we've got our final girl. Kelly is the final girl survivor for after Lee's killed off. So we're not sure. Lee makes it all the way to the hospital, but she's still killed off. I really thought she was going to make it. So director Glenn Morgan actually gave several of these girls characteristics of a final girl. Like Heather, for example, is genre savvy and modest. Melissa is a caring mom. She's a caring team mom. Dana has like a take charge attitude. And Lee has more of a backstory. Kelly averts many final girl attributes, such as having a boyfriend with whom she's implied to have a sexual relationship with. And of course, being the lone blonde in the group. So we've got some more foreshadowing with Dana when she says, "I'd like to bury the hatchet with my sister right in her head." Agnes kills her with a rake in her head. So pretty dead on. Then we've got our hostile weather that's keeping everyone trapped in the house with this predator, this psychotic killer, and no help can come to them. They're stuck there. They have to stick it out. Either way, they're dead. When they call the police, they're told that the police can't show up for at least 2 hours, which is an insanely long time to have a friend with a decapitated head and people going missing left and right. So like many tropes in horror movies, we've got to have a little bit of nudity. Gotta have that boob shot. The shower scene we have is of Lauren, who is drunkenly taking a shower, trying to get that stink off her from, I don't know, I guess she just smells boozy from boozing it up all day. And while she's in the shower, she has the killer spying through a peephole. There are plenty of red herrings just like thrown about in this movie. We've got Eve, who's obsessed with Billy Lenz, even taking his old room in the sorority house. She's initially implied to be the second killer until they find her decapitated head. Like even the giving the gift of the unicorn is a reference to Barb's death in the original Black Christmas with that unusually large glass unicorn horn. With Eve, she's also wearing glasses, which makes you think, like, maybe she is the sister, maybe she is Agnes, because Agnes obviously is going to have some issues with her eyes later on, since she only has one of them, you know. But that, I was wrong there, and very obviously wrong. It was too on the nose. And then we've got Lee, who is introduced suspiciously only after Claire has disappeared. She has a different last name on her ID and would possibly be the right age to be Agnes, but she's actually Claire's half-sister. She's also the person that finds the gift that's marked as from Billy. Then last but not least, we have our bad boy who's been living in the area and knows all the history of the house and the gruesome murders. He also has his little angry outbursts when he doesn't get his way. All of these people seem like eligible candidates for the role of serial killer, but it turns out it's none of them. Some quick trivia on the movie before we move on. At the beginning, during one scene at the beginning of the movie where the sorority girls are all sitting around the fireplace, the famous leg lamp from The Christmas Story can be seen in the background. This is likely a homage to Bob Clark. If you didn't like this version, you aren't the only one. Glenn Morgan has reportedly disowned this film. very strong words, especially around the holidays, disowning things. In response to the question on whether or not he was happy with the result, Morgan said, "No way." And it's schizophrenic because Bob Weinstein came in and urinated on it. After talking to his lawyer and agent, he agreed to stay on to try and protect the cast and crew, which were friends of his. So with the Weinstein name ringing a lot of alarm bells, I would say that Morgan was right to stay and use his influence to protect them. Bob Clark was involved in the 2006 remake of Black Christmas as an executive producer and a source of input for the screenplay. I can't imagine that he was very happy with this version either.
All he wants for Christmas
is Megan in her room.
Is a new family he can treat like his very own.
Now for the true crime of it all. In writing the character of Billy, Morgan was inspired by the real life of Edmund Kemper, also known as the Coed Killer. He is a real-life serial killer who, as a child, had been locked in the basement of his home by his mother, whom he later murdered. At age 15, Edmund Kemper killed both his grandparents to see what it felt like. Upon release, he drifted picking up and releasing female hitchhikers, but he soon stopped letting them go. Killing six young women in the Santa Cruz, California area in the 1970s. In 1973, he killed his mother and her friend before turning himself in. Kemper was born on December 18, 1948 in Burbank, California, as the middle child. After his parents divorced in 1957, he moved with his mother and two sisters to Montana. Kemper had a difficult relationship with his alcoholic mother, as she was very critical of him and he blamed her for all of his problems. When he was 10 years old, she forced him to live in the basement away from his sisters, whom she feared he might harm in some way. I can't say that I blame her for seeing signs of a sociopath, but she definitely had play in that. Signs of trouble began to emerge early. Kemper had a dark fantasy life, sometimes dreaming about killing his mother. He cut off the heads of his sister's dolls and even coerced the girls into playing a game called Gas Chamber. His first victims were the family cat. He went to live with his father for a time, but ended up back with his mother, who decided to send the troubled teenager to live with his parental grandparents. He had already begun learning about firearms, but his grandparents took away his rifle after he killed several birds and other small animals. Good job, grandparents. You don't let that kid have a gun. On August 27th, 1964, Kemper finally turned his building rage on his grandparents. The 15-year-old shot his grandmother in the kitchen after an argument. And when his grandfather returned home, Kemper went outside and shot him by his car. Afterward, he called his mother, who told him to call the police. Later, Kemper said he shot his grandmother to see what it felt like. He added that he had killed his grandfather so that the man wouldn't have to find out that his wife had been murdered. Kemper was eventually sent to maximum security facility for mentally ill victims. In 1969, Kemper was released at the age of 21, despite his prison doctor's recommendation that he does not live with his mother because of her past abuse and his psychological issues involving her. He rejoined her in Santa Cruz, California. Kemper had applied to become a state trooper, but he was rejected because of his size. Not the murderous rampage that he went on when he was 15 years old, but his size kept him back from being a state trooper because he weighed around 300 pounds and he was 6'9" inches tall. which led to his nickname, Big Ed. However, he did hang around some of the Santa Cruz police officers. The same year, he began working for the highway department. Kemper was hit by a car while out on a motorcycle, karma. His arm was badly injured, and he received a $15,000 settlement in the civil suit he filed against the car's driver. Unable to work, Kemper turned his mind towards other pursuits. Not a good thing for this guy. He noticed a large number of young women hitchhiking in the area. At first, Kemper picked up female hitchhikers and let them go. However, when he offered a ride to two Fresno State students, Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Lucessa, they would never make it to their destination. Their families reported them missing soon thereafter, but nothing would be known of their fates until August 15th, when a female head was discovered in the woods near Santa Cruz and was later identified as Pesky's. Lucessa's remains, however, were never found. Later that year, on September 14th, 1972, Kemper picked up 15-year-old Aiko, I think I said that right, I'm not sure, who had decided to hitchhike rather than wait for the bus to take her to dance class. She would meet the same fate as Pesky and Lucessa. In January 1973, Kemper continued to act on his murderous impulses, picking up hitchhiker Cindy Shaw, whom he shot and killed. While his mother was out, Kemper went to her home and hid Shaw's body in his room. On February 5th, 1973, Kemper used a campus parking sticker his mother had given him to facilitate a double murder. He drove to the university where he offered a ride to two students, Rosalind Thorpe and Alice Liu. Shortly after picking them up, he shot the two young women, then drove past the campus security at the gates with the two mortally wounded women in the car. In March, some of Thorpe's and Liu's remains were discovered by hikers near Highway 1. In April 1973, Kemper committed what would be his last two murders. Kemper attacked his mother after she went to sleep, first striking her in the head with a hammer and then cutting her throat with a knife. As he had with the other victims, he then decapitated her and cut off her hands, but then also removed her larynx and put it down the garbage disposal. Guess he really didn't want to listen to her anymore, not even in the afterlife. After hiding his mother's body parts, Kemper called his mother's friend, Sally Hallett, and invited her over to the house. Kemper then strangled Hallett shortly after she arrived and hid her body in the closet. He made a call to the Santa Cruz police to confess his crimes. At first, they did not believe that the guy they knew as Big Ed was the killer. Charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder, Kemper went on trial for his crimes in October 1973. He was found guilty of all charges. At present, Kemper is serving his time in California. He was denied parole as recently as July of this year. Let's end on a high note. If you've listened to my first few episodes, you'll notice that I'm still trying to like find my groove with everything, trying to just find the flow, what feels right with pacing and where certain information should fit in. If you have any feedback, I am more than happy to take that feedback and grow with it. I'm still in my infancy with this whole thing, and I want to make it the best it can possibly be. If you would like to collaborate on something, I would love the opportunity to connect with more people in the horror scene, especially here in Orlando, where my home base is. I have a horror event monthly at Conduit in Orlando, Florida, and my next one is going to be on December 16th, where I will be your host. The movies I cover each month at my events will also be what I cover on this podcast. So if you plan on attending any of my events, this would be a good place to get a leg up on everyone else for the trivia portion of the night. My horror events at Conduit are more than just trivia. It's about creating a community around the horror scene. At my events, there are themed drinks. The bartender she's amazing. She puts together whole menus for my events. I have themed decorations. There's going to be movies playing. If you are a horror fan, this is just an opportunity to immerse yourself in the horrordom. In my next event, I will be covering the 1974 cult classic Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark. I will also cover the 2006 remake of Black Christmas, directed by Glenn Morgan, which I covered in this episode, and the 2019 remake directed by Sofia Takal, which I will be covering in my next episode. There is also going to be a macabre market at Conduit on Sunday, December 15th. It's called Market of the Beast, and it will feature all kinds of gifts for your morbid loved ones. At the market, I will be running a photo spot where you can take pictures with a cosplay of Art, the clown, as a cosplay of Santa. I will be creating a reenactment of the Santa scene in Terrifier 3, where you can get your Christmas pictures just in time for the holidays. My goal is to have an episode a week, so please be patient with me as I'm learning all of this as I go. My future self is very much scolding me with hot water and stuff. Thank you for listening, and don't forget your sacrificial gift to Billy under the Christmas tree. Until next time, goodbye.